You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings, and welcome to another fantastic episode of Around the Block. Boy, we have a good one for you today. We're going to talk about... We get calls, as you can imagine. What do we do? What do you guys do? Can you guys help me? Can you not help us? Whatever. So we're gonna talk about some of the services that we do offer, and I know Susan wanted to add a few other things. So
yeah,
that's what we're gonna talk about.
Yeah. So last week we talked about a recent case and recent circuit court case relevant to compassionate release, and that had some really interesting things. And I try real hard to stay up on the cases, and I tend not to dig into the district court cases, because the individual district court cases are what they are. But when things start to elevate to circuit court level, then it becomes interesting. So we've got some circuit court cases we'll discuss. Also wanted to talk a little bit about the services we provide. Some folks call us, as Bruce said, knowing what the issue is. They've been following us on Facebook. They've been watching the podcast and things like that. But other people kind of like, in fact, we've had cases, calls where, they actually thought Federal Prison Authority was a government agency.
The BOP itself.
And we are not the BOP.
Not the BOP.
Bruce Form. Geez, how long have you been doing this? I know I've only joined you, 2 years ago, but
a little bit before COVID, we started. I started with the CARES Act, and instead of it was early release federal prison CARES Act, and so we had a really bountiful start with COVID. And when people were getting out in the CARES Act, and who was going to get out and how they're going to get out and all this other stuff. And that was kind of the birth of that. And the major service line of Federal Prison Authority, the website and the business. And so then with the First Step Act and now the Second Chance Act, and then just all the other things that the Bureau involves, back in the day, I took cases that I don't take now.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously we've had some good personnel changes, and Susan's awesome, so we had the gentleman that was with me before retired. He has a lot of grandkids and everything, and he needed, he wanted to jump off the bus, and I would too. And at some point I will.
Yeah.
But
your background with the RRMs made for a good fit when the CARES Act came out, and we were looking at large scale numbers of folks moving into home confinement. So your background really lended to that. As we shifted, and of course I've come on board, and my entire career has been, well, with the exception of that first year as a correctional officer, has been in case management and working my way up. So the First Step Act, classification, even some of just the day-to-day stuff, we get those questions, those kind of quirky questions sometimes about not necessarily FSA. And of course on Facebook, we see that those questions. So it's nice that, that you have that community where folks can ask questions, even if they're not necessarily relevant to the First Step Act. And I think that's really important. Right.
And the other thing we're not lawyers. We're not going to do these motions. And I know a lot of these other prison consultants are making a ton of money, probably drafting these 2241s and doing all this other stuff, man. That is the express lane to problems and trouble, and
at a minimum, it's unethical, at a minimum. Right. Obviously you and I, we don't have that expertise. Uh, we, uh, obviously we've got experience with compassionate release. We have experience with some of the other legal things, clemency, compassionate release, inmate IHP for immigration cases, administrative remedy, which of course is that path toward a 2241. But we stay in our lane and stay with the Bureau stuff. And when we get those calls, we don't try to,
right?
You know, we've told more than one person, I'm sorry, that's just not what we do.
We're not lawyers. We don't do that, you know?
You know, and I think that's important, you know, to maintain a standard.
It is. And so, you know, the phone rings when it's meant to ring and clients come when they're meant to come. And that's that. So,
you know, one of the most important things I think we do, separate from my FSA is important and all of that, but from my perspective and my years is dealing with the pre-sentence investigation report. And when we're being brought on before that PSR is final and we can review it and identify problems, and it's not, you know, I can't tell you how many times somebody says, well, should I just tell them I'm homeless, you know, or should I just do X? No, you know, we're not going to coach you on what to say or what not to say. But what we want is, as a former case manager, as a former case management coordinator, when I look at a PSR, I know how the Bureau is going to score it. And when it's vague, incomplete, when pending charges don't have accurate information, when high school diploma isn't verified, when medical information is scant, that makes the Bureau's job, one, more difficult. And, you know, having spent 30 plus years with them, I don't like to see that be made more difficult. But it also messes up designation. It also messes up access in terms of halfway house and home confinement, program eligibility, and all these other things. So from my perspective, one of the most important things we do is getting involved early on to hopefully send, when someone is facing federal incarceration, they really, really need an accurate, thorough, complete pre-sentence investigation report.
Absolutely. And we got a call yesterday, the day before, or last week, I guess, because today's Monday. But when are you going to go to prison? Self-surrender tomorrow at 2.
It's like, yeah, like that is seriously the wrong time to be calling. I mean, if we're free, but, you know, we do have clients that are calling and, you know, for someone to like want the day before, like that's really tough.
We got to deal with our family members. We'll be talking to your family members if you want to move forward with services.
Yeah,
you still certainly get services, but
absolutely
it's going to be hard to do an orientation. It's going to be hard to tell you to do some of the initial steps that you need to do
with that
type of a timeline. But
you know, and the orientation we do is another really important thing. And I know some people take advantage of it and some people don't, but we're not just, I mean, obviously we go through the logistics of, you know, voluntary surrendering and what to expect and those kind of things. But more important than that, because again, going back to, we understand case management and we understand the things that are going to have to be accomplished for individuals with those short sentences or shorter sentences, they need to know, like walking in the door, like what's that map going to look like? What's that path they're going to take? And if they know and they understand the timelines and when things need to be talked about and not wait for their case manager to bring up something, that is, to me, a very valuable tool. And I'm not just saying it because we sell that, but like, I can't tell you how many times as a case manager and case management coordinator, I had folks, you know, tell me, well, the lawyer said, and my judge said, and this and that. And I'm like, you know, dude, that's not how it works. And you know, I kind of have to fill them in, and then they're feeling bad, you know, and they're like, but I was told, and I'm like, I'm sorry, they don't work for the Bureau. So those are some of the real important resources. Another thing before we jump into the cases, I wanted to share, there was a Facebook post about a family member concerned about a loved one having gone into the hospital. I think you probably saw it. And, the issue of will the Bureau call? And the answer is only if that person is quite literally at death's door. And I know that that is going to sound really harsh and cold, but the reality is when there is an individual in the community, if they are supposed to be behind it, and maybe there's a little bit of latitude when the individual is minimum security and they're at a camp, but when you're talking about someone who's serving time behind a secure fence or a secure wall, there's a reason, and they're not going to disclose information about the person being at the outside hospital unless it's absolutely necessary. Now, in the case of this person, I explained that, you know, they could be at the hospital, but if they're stable, if they're doing okay, Bureau is not going to call you. Now, we know other folks in the housing unit, on the pod, they share phone numbers, and invariably we'll hear, oh, I got a phone call from his cellmate. I got a phone call from a guy on the unit. One person commented that they got a call from someone on the unit with a cell phone. Again, cell phones are illegal. But in those situations, kind of one of the best strategies is to have a release of information consent form signed by your loved one before they go to prison. Right. And then you as a family member can reach out to the prison directly and ask for a status update, ask about them. And you already have that signed consent and release information. That's one of the things we do with our clients. We get those consent to release information signed before they ever walk in the door. You know, if we pick up a client later, we're sending a release of information form with instructions to the family member to mail in, have them complete, mail back out. And that slows the process down. Excuse me. But when it comes to before you walk in the door, a lot of people focus on that power of attorney. That power of attorney means nothing inside the fence. Inside the Bureau, the power of attorney does not help. A power of attorney is for you as a family member to be doing things for your loved one on the outside, going to court and getting documents, taking care of business, family business, whatever the case is. Inside, the Bureau is not going to release information unless they have that signed ROI form. So just kind of a little tidbit.
Now, are we going to talk about the case that went from institution A to institution
We can talk about that. So, you know, we did have a recent case, and there was, it was a TI deactivation case. So for those of you who know, terminal ileum deactivated and everybody got moved elsewhere. Right. And they were all over the place, and there's still people trying to get to their newly designated facility. And, TI also was a Care 3 facility, which means Care Level Medical 3 means they had folks who were less healthy. And we had a client who, in the process of moving, had a health event. And again, we were able to nudge the process. I guess that's a good way to describe it. Rattle a few chains to get him going in the right direction, getting him out of that holdover site and over to his designated facility. Very happy that he was able to do that. One of the Kobayashi Marus of being ill and in transit is they want to get you to your designated facility, But if you're not medically stable to transport, they can't move you. So you have to be medically stable. And he had to go to the outside hospital. And like I said, he's doing better and now where he needs to be. But that's one of the challenges when you are health compromised, is if you have an event that kind of puts the brakes on movement, because they can't put you in the air or on a bus or wherever you're going to go if you're in bad shape. So you gotta get stabilized. So that was what we were that's what we were dealing with, was, is he medically stable enough to move? Okay, he is. Like, it's a win-win to get him out of a holdover institution, right? And the holdover institution doesn't want him there.
And the person was also in RDAP.
And in RDAP, yes. Yeah, so the RDAP was interrupted.
But only for a day in terms of...
Yeah, when he got to his new site, they got him re-enrolled really right away. That was awesome. It was a win-win all the way around to get him out of holdover and get him. Right. So that was good.
That's one example. And you know what? If you're listening to this show and you're thinking, don't focus on it. Oh, well, that was a medical case, or, oh, well, that was a deactivation, reduction in force. Well, it was, but the fact is how we were able to, and who we were able to communicate with about the situation to get this thing moved along. I'm telling you, this thing keeps falling out. That's the name of the game, I think, with what we do. Make no mistake about it. Susan and I, but to agree, I mean, man, these pre-sentence report thing and getting hired early and being able to absolutely put the jeweler's glass on and go over that pre-sentence report, that is an honor. If we get the chance to do that, we can do that. But at the end of the day, you know, and those are our fantasy cases because we're academics and we love that. But however, at the end of the day, man, we're some trench mofos. I mean, we were in the trenches. And so,
has to be done.
Yeah.
You know, and when we communicate, because we know our communication with institutions, with the regions, is really as insiders, to be honest, in terms of, you know, how we talk about whether it's transfers or whether it's halfway house or classification. We don't just know the policies. We know that kind of insider language because we were there for so long. So, and we try to help.
Right. And who the decision makers are at the right level. Cause you can intercede at the wrong level and get jammed up. And so if you intercede at the right level, your stuff goes straight through, and then the person ends up getting the changes made they need made in a more seamless and effortless way. And so that's what you're really getting with us is that ability. You just can't. It is what it is.
Well, we see it all the time on the Facebook page when somebody asks something, and the first thing is, "Oh, call DSCC." Like, DSCC is not the end all and be all. No. And our goal is really, because we come in at the right level in terms of who we talk to and at what level we talk to, we are also not getting hemmed up in the bureaucratic red tape. We don't recommend administrative remedy unless it's necessary. Administrative remedy, and we've talked about it on the show, can be a very long and drawn out process. So if you can get the problem fixed at the institution level, then there's no need to go to administrative remedy. We've even had responses from some institutions that were like very, very generic responses. And that said, if he's dissatisfied with the decision, he can file administrative remedy. And our response back was, this isn't an administrative remedy issue. And we would then explain, this is incorrect. This is, whether it's his points or his pattern or his custody classification. And then we're a little in the policy wonk weed, citing chapter and verse of whatever relevant policy is appropriate. Right. So it's kind of fun.
So it is. Yeah, it is. It is fun. Okay.
All right. So I know you want to get this wanted to tackle just a few circuit court cases. Some of these are not surprises as far as Bruce and I are concerned, but we wanted to kind of share them. So there have been, there was a lot of, I'll call it excitement, over a Ninth Circuit case last year. And any of us who have worked in the system for any length of time know that just because the Ninth Circuit says so means nothing.
Right.
Because it's the Ninth Circuit, bless their hearts. And I'm trying to pull this up here, so I'm taking my glasses off so I can read. And this is a March 26, 2026 decision out of the Second Circuit. This is Riviera Perez versus Stover. Stover is Rick Stover, but when he was this was from a case from when he was warden at Danbury still. Okay. So in the course of the decision, and this had to do with application of time credits towards shortening supervised release. Now, as we have talked about, gosh, on this show, I can't even tell you how many times, and we talk about it in the books, there is no third door. Time credits are applied to early release and early pre-release, period, end of sentence. And this circuit court, second court, sent essentially the same thing. Now, that's not the important part, although interesting. In this case, they referenced other cases, including cases out of the Sixth Circuit, the 11th Circuit, the Fourth and Fifth Circuit, and then, of course, the Ninth Circuit. And all of those circuits, with the exception of the Ninth, found the same, came to the same conclusion, that FSA does not shorten, cannot be used to shorten your SRT time. And what is particularly interesting about this case is Mr. Rivera Perez filed an appeal to the Supreme Court. And on April 20th, so last week, the court denied his petition to elevate to the Supreme Court. So at this point in time, we have, what was that count? 6 or 7 circuits. I lost my count here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like 6 or 7. Anyway, it doesn't matter. And 1 against. But the fact that the Supreme Court was not willing to accept the case for further hearing, I really consider this a dead issue.
You know, because now folks listen to this analogy, and Susan's going to have to clean it up. As Bureau of Prisons officials, we never told the Sentencing Commission what to do. As Bureau of Prisons officials, we never told a judge out of the judicial branch what to do. Not once. Conversely, something that's a Justice Department derivative, such as FSA, why are you going to cross-pollinate that back into the judicial branch during supervised release? Yeah, from an inmate perspective, you're still being restricted, but you've been involved in two distinctly orthogonally rotated, for our statistical friends, thank you, two different branches of the government, and they operate differently. Their procurement is different.
Well, it's even more than that. It's really not the Bureau, because the Bureau is only implementing, as part of the executive branch, what Congress passed. And there's one line in the SRT, in the FSA, that talks about credit toward supervised release. One word in one sentence, yet it completely ignores the whole notion that SRT is applied to advance the transfer of someone to supervised release, which is spelled out verbatim in the statute. So, I mean, bless their hearts, in the Ninth Circuit, you know, as the running joke is, just because it happens in the Ninth, you know, means nothing. But I really do think the fact that the Supreme Court last week opted not to accept this petition to hear the case, I really think that's a dead issue.
And folks, it's all is not lost, because regular folks get out, do a year of their supervised release, and sometimes get it cut. Right. So it's not like all hope is lost by getting your supervised release term short.
Yeah. There are other provisions to petition to shorten supervised release. This is just saying those FSA credit days that you may or may not think you have coming and are not accounted for, that's a different subject, can don't get to be used to shorten your sentence. Now, personally, And you and I talked about it, and it's in our article, and it's in our the last chapter of the second edition book. We think there's some benefit there.
Sure.
I, you know, if I was going to wave my magic wand and change the dynamics of how credit is applied, I would not have somebody hanging out in halfway house for or home confinement for 2-3+ years. While on FSA, and allowing a block of time that could be used at the discretion of probation and the court as a carrot. You know, think about if you were sitting here with 365 days of unused, you know, if you change the structure, right? This is in this hypothetical world where we change the law and we apply more, you know, what I would like to see, particularly for individuals with longer sentences, and that's what we're talking about here, is I would like to see individuals with longer sentence be able to apply more credit toward their earlier release. And then an additional, and based on a percentage, 10-15% of their sentence where they could earn a reduction, and then up to a year in halfway house. Well, by definition, you're going to have extra time. So if you're sitting here with another year of time credits that could be applied to shorten your supervised release, you know, at the recommendation, with the recommendation of probation to that, that your supervision court, that's a nice little carrot to have. Right. And, and I think that would be far better than to be sitting in home confinement for 3 years.
And first of all, for numerous reasons, one, you don't want to have these home confinement and RRC spaces clogged with these longer term cases. You want to see some turnaround. Number two, psychologically for the inmate, I can't tell you how many CARES Act people are saying, I'm going crazy.
Yeah,
I've been in this halfway house now for 4 years, right? Because COVID was 2021.
Well, think about at the end of the Biden administration, the number of individuals they opted to grant clemency to, because they had already, some of them, as few as a year, but many of them had already 2 and 3 years in home confinement and had 2 and 3 and 4 more to go. And the, regardless of your politics, I think that was a good decision. If you've been sitting in home confinement for 3 years and been doing well, and you haven't gotten in trouble, and you haven't had to be moved back into the halfway house for a timeout because, you know, you did something you weren't supposed to as a sanction, you know, why not consider it? So anyway, so that is a long time to be in home confinement. I would much rather see, like I said, the Bureau be able to hand off credit to probation. Not saying that you're guaranteed to get it, but as that incentive to apply and be used to reduce. Okay, so now the next three cases are interesting. So you and I did an op-ed back, in the fall of 2024. When two cases came out, one was Pelio v. Warden, and the other one was Sharma v. Peters. And the article, I think we called it something like BOP needs to show their work, right? This issue comes down to my brain just stopped working there for a second. This issue comes down to this notion of when can you start earning FSA, right? And or the federal time credits, programming days to accumulate, right? And the Bureau uses the admission date, and this is what was promulgated in the rules, and this has been the bone of contention, is you have to be at your designated facility, whether you voluntarily surrender to your designated facility or you're in you're remanded, you're in marshal's custody, and you get to your designated facility. So now why does the Bureau do that? No, it's not because the Bureau is mean and is looking to keep people in prison longer. The Bureau does that because the way the law is written, as the Bureau understands it, and I was there for those discussions in terms of the drafting of the policy and that early language, an individual, mm-hmm. in order to earn time credits, has to successfully participate in programming. The programming, and we can do a refresher on that at another day. The programming is not just any old programming, right? I run around the institution and I do everything I want to do. I do and say, okay, I'm programming. Rather, the programming is tailored programming based on a needs assessment that's been completed. And then individuals are assigned to programs, EBBRs, evidence-based recidivism reducing programs and productive activities that are directly related to that need area. So if you do not have a high school diploma, this is an easy one. If you don't have a high school diploma or a GED, well, the Bureau is, your case manager is going to say, you have a need because you haven't completed it. And we're recommending the GED program. That's a very clear-cut one. You have a history, you've completed a self-assessment, and you have a history of anger and hostility. Well, we want to see you involved in the anger management program. You have a history of bad decision-making, some stinking thinking that has resulted in a whole host of problems that has continued to have you be involved with the law in a negative way, right? So we're going to want to see you, we're going to recommend some CBT, some cognitive behavior therapy, maybe some dialectic behavior therapy, the CBT, any number of problem solving, better decision making. There's a whole host of programs related to this. Because the way you are making decisions is leading you to criminal activity. So you as the individual with this need, whether it's substance abuse or cognition or whatever the case is, you have been recommended for specific programming. And then you complete those. And then the Bureau says, you know what? You are doing the things you are supposed to do. You are satisfactorily completing programming. We are awarding programming days. And with those programming days, you can earn FTCs. Great. Well, what about the person who's sitting with the marshals? Whether it's for a few days, a few weeks, or a couple of months. Yes. So back when Pelio and Charmin were decided, it was extremely interesting, even though they were still district level cases. And if you look at the cases since then, now I have not looked at every district court case since then. I've looked at a lot. Basically, in all of those cases, the Bureau, the courts were like, Bureau, admission status isn't in the law. So we want you to go back and show your work. Did he complete recommended programming? Was he assigned to programming while he was sitting in a county jail? No, he was not. He hadn't completed a risk and need assessment. He didn't do programming. Boom. Bob's your uncle. You're not getting programming. So basically, because the Bureau does use, because this is all keyed into software, right? So that 155,000 people can be checked every single month, right? Actually, on a daily basis now. So admission codes that were identified related to when did that person show up at their designated facility? Believe it or not, the Bureau can tell. The computer system is sophisticated enough to know that if you were sitting in a county jail, sitting in a detention, Bureau detention center, sitting in a holdover unit, and whether or not you did programming. But it's not just any programming. So now you're sitting in Chicago, you're in MDC Chicago, and you're just doing any program you can get your hands on so that you can say, I've been programming. Except the way the law is written, as the Bureau interpreted, and this is something I 100% agree with, the Bureau is to assign programming based on needs. And if you have not completed a needs assessment, which you do not do until you are at your designated facility and you go through initial classification, then you're not programming, because the Bureau gets to define satisfactory programming under the law. So what do we have from that? So first off, there was a case out of the Fourth Circuit that was decided in January, and just the individual wanted his case reheard, and that was just decided last week on the 22nd. White versus Warden of Correctional Institution Cumberland. This was an individual who was in, this was an in-transit case. So this person was in, was moving institutions and was sitting over in Oklahoma City, I believe, for 3 days, and was like, oh no, I should get my time. And the Bureau said, no, you were in transit. You were out of the institution. You were not programming. Interestingly enough, the court agreed with, the circuit court agreed with the Bureau. It was cited at the district level. He appealed. It went up to the circuit court in the Fourth Circuit. The Fourth Circuit agreed. And then Mr. Williams resubmitted and said, oh no, I forgot. I actually got a packet from psychology that I was working on while I was sitting in SHU for 3 days. Well, the court kind of didn't believe him. It was not a unanimous decision. It was a 3-2, it was a 2-1 decision out of circuit court, with the same judge who dissented on the first one, dissented on not rehearing it. But basically they said, you getting some kind, you know, you through the whole case said you didn't do any programming. You and the Bureau both agreed you weren't programming for those 3 days. And now all of a sudden you were.
Yeah, the packet. Yeah.
Yeah. We're not reopening this. So that was, again, just decided. And that was interesting because it is an in-transit case between designated facilities, as opposed to the those folks that are haven't got to their initial institution. And so that was just done. Now, the interesting ones. So I'm going to start with the first one. There's another Fourth Circuit case. In this case, the individual was sitting in a county marshal contract county facility, and he says he was doing programming that was comparable to what the Bureau does. And so this presents an interesting question, and it goes to, can the Bureau define, is the Bureau allowed to define what is satisfactory participation? And the Bureau has consistently said it's got to be an EBBR or PA as listed in the program guide, right? Consistently. And in this case, the district court ruled against him. This is Benson v. Warden FCI Edgefield. Ruled against him, went to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the court remanded it back to the district, not because of the argument itself, but this case was one of those, if, as it was working its way through, if we remember the, we talked about Chevron and the Loper case that threw out Chevron and kind of, we start over, the circuit court sent it back to the district court to reevaluate their decision, not thinking about Chevron, but thinking about Loper. Because of course the Supreme Court threw Chevron out. That was a huge, huge, huge decision. You know,
I tend to see things this through a program based lens. I mean, somebody who, like the guy who was an RDAP, excuse me, the guy is an RDAP and he gets snatched up for a good reason because of his health care and the closure or whatever. But he doesn't get RDAP days for not being an RDAP while he was in transit. No problem. Probably no argument. No lawsuit because it's a program-based decision, right?
Right.
And so, so that's
and then when
this
he picks
is.
Up on the other side, he starts in again, right where he left
sure,
off.
And that's fine. And they did that. So I think the mindset here is to look at this as more of a program-based thing versus just like day for day, I'm doing my time and, you know, therefore I want to be in earning status. I'm being good. And therefore I have something coming. It's are you in the program? Are you in earning status? Right.
Right. So, right.
Yeah.
And also thinking about a program from a program standpoint, you know, one of the things the Bureau went through is, okay, so the Bureau has always offered anger management classes around the Bureau. And if there was, I will affectionately say, if there was 122 institutions, there's not now, but if there was 122 institutions, there was 122 different anger management classes. What's happening now, the anger management, I'm just picking on that one, the anger management class is a standardized program that is delivered the same way with the same structure by psychologists around the agency. And that has to do with program efficacy. Just like the RDAP program is a standardized program, one of the things that was done when the whole program, all of the programs were assessed, was they started standardizing everything. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the person who is, you could have had an anger management class that lasted 6 weeks over here, but 12 weeks over there and 26 weeks at another institution. This moving toward the efficacy of the program, which is important when you consider that the law also requires annual validation. These programs are being reviewed. Is there an impact? Is something rightfully an EBBR, or should it be a productive activity? Or is it it's currently listed as a productive activity, but they're really seeing, because of the research, they're really seeing and saying, you know what, we need to move this up. This is an EBBR. And this is all being driven by research. So research, in order to really have good data, they need a standardized program that's delivered the same way, whether that's, you know, it's a small group and, you know, of no more than 12 inmates for 10 weeks in 2 hour intervals, that kind of dosage of how it's administered. They need that standardization. So to say, well, I took a comparable program in a county jail is meaningless. I mean, it's good you stayed out of trouble and you did some programming, but in terms of FSA, that data, A, is not comparable to what's going on. And B, and more importantly, when you're sitting in a county jail, the Bureau has no documentation. In fact, for individuals who are remanded to custody, other than the administrative admission to load your data and designate your case, you don't exist in the Bureau until you show up on site.
Yeah.
Because you know, the Bureau is not somehow connected to everybody else, every other county and state facility. So that's going right. that's not as interesting though as the next one. And I've got just a few minutes and I know I can get this in. So there was a case, and this was actually decided last year, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, August 14th of 2025. And it is currently on appeal with the Seventh Circuit. So this is a case, and this is one to watch. This is extremely interesting. I know how I think it should be decided, but I'm not a lawyer or a judge. So this is Stark v. Lammer. This was a case out of the Northern District of Illinois. And in this case has to do with specifically, well, there's a couple of different points, but the one of particular interest for me personally, the academic geek that I am, is in terms of getting credit prior, in between that time, between sentencing and your first institution. The Bureau has consistently focused on, when you get to your initial institution, you go through that intake and initial classification, you get your needs assessment done, then you have your 28, you know, within your 28 days, you get your initial classification. and programs are recommended. And as long as you are compliant and get everything done in terms of, you know, your self-assessments, that's the one thing that can hold you up. But you get everything done. The Bureau grants you programming days from the first day that you arrive in the institution. Well, this question, this individual challenged the Bureau on whether or not a needs assessment was required. Essentially
5 minutes.
Yes. Essentially is does the need, the completion of the needs assessment, is that is that the reason? It's not just that you were programming, but, and, or weren't programming, but does anything you do before the need, completing that needs assessment count? Or is, again, going back to that successful programming, and the Bureau has said successful programming is based on a completed needs assessment and assigning to programming from staff, and that the programming and the needs assessment are linked. It's not just random, throw everything at the wall programming. And in this case, the district court ruled in the Bureau's favor that there is this linkage and that that is legitimate. But it is being appealed. It's with the Seventh Circuit. I'm going to be watching this one closely because it really gets to the heart of all of these other district court cases about when can you actually start beginning to earn programs. So if you think about going back to Pelio and Sharma, and the court said, hey, tell us if he was programming. You can't just say this admission date. You have to look in and show your work. To now we're saying, well, the reason that this programming doesn't get to count is because they have to do this needs assessment first. And these needs assessments are not done in marshal custody. They're not done in county jails. They are done as part of initial classification at your initially designated institution within those first 28 days. So that's going to be a really, really interesting one because it shuts down the rest of these arguments. And again, we have been very consistent on our position. And I will tell you, I personally did a lot of declarations to explain this very issue that you're not doing a needs assessment when you're sitting in, you know, some county jail somewhere or a marshal right. facility or even a Bureau detention facility. You're not completing yeah. that because it's not done. So right. it's kind of, this will be the interesting one to follow. Stark versus Lammer. And I will stay on that one. But so that right. is where we're at. And yes,
like fantasy football, fantasy football, like DraftKings on Star
yep,
versus
this
Lammer.
Is the one to watch.
Get your bets in on that.
Yep, this is the one to
minus
watch.
Minus 112 Vegas odds on that Star versus Lammer. Anyway,
it's the Bureau did a solid argument on it, and I yeah. will tell you, I agree with it.
Yeah, no, that, like I said, we'll see what happens. Well, folks, there it is, another fantastic show. Talked about some services, talked about some court cases. Again, next time we'll have some more fantastic. Probably some more services stuff too, and we can go over some of our cases, because they're
we haven't done that in a while.
Very, very exciting, you know, cases. Mm-hmm. So, okay, we'll come to our Facebook group, early release Federal Prison First Step Act. Come to our YouTube channel, First Step Act. Come to LA Talk Radio and download all of our prior episodes. And MP3 and MP4 files. Go to Apple Podcasts. Yeah, what now?
Follow us on YouTube.
Follow us and comment yeah. on YouTube. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Like, subscribe, and follow on YouTube. So, and Apple Podcasts and some other stuff there. So, yeah. always feel free to reach out to us, ask us questions on any of our platforms. We're always happy to get back with you. And so we like to educate as well as have clients, but a lot of, I think it's more than half of what we do is educate people on these phone calls. So we're glad to do it. Okay, everybody. Well, have a great week And we'll see you here next time on Around the Block on LA Talk Radio. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.